From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, January 29th, 2019. And on this day, a bill in the legislature would put consumer protections under the Affordable Care Act into state law. We'll look at the promises and concerns about the bill. And we'll look at why members of Maine's Penobscot Nation are opposing Governor Janet Mills' pick to lead the Department of Environmental Protection. That's ahead in just a moment. Today, the Health Coverage, Insurance, and Financial Services Committee considered a bill that would codify consumer protections under the Affordable Care Act into state law. The goal is to protect Mainers from future efforts to dismantle the ACA. But as Patty White reports, some insurance providers are concerned the bill would only protect access and not affordability.
The bill was sparked by attempts over the past several years to undermine the ACA. Most recently, a federal court ruling in Texas last December that found the law to be unconstitutional. The ACA is still in effect while the case is under appeal, but as a safeguard, Democratic leaders in the Maine legislature have introduced an emergency bill to put ACA protections into state law. Troy Jackson is Senate president.
The idea is that Mainers don't get left in the lurch in the event that the ACA goes away.
The bill, LD1, would require that insurance plans cover essential health benefits, such as maternity care, mental health care, and substance use treatment. It would allow children to stay on their parents' insurance plans till age 26. LD1 would prohibit insurers from charging substantially higher rates to seniors because of their age, and bars denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, such as Kate Brogan's 5-year-old son. Brogan says he has type 1 diabetes.
Like all type 1 diabetics, my son needs multiple injections of insulin every day to survive. There's no known cause for type 1 diabetes and no cure. Health insurance has kept my son alive for the past 2 years and will be essential to his future health.
Brogan was one of several Mainers who rely on ACA coverage and its protections who testified in support of LD1 during a public hearing Tuesday. The bill also has the backing of Governor Janet Mills and several health and advocacy organizations, including the Maine Medical Association, Consumers for Affordable Healthcare, and the Alliance for Addiction and Mental Health Services. Executive Director Mallory Shaughnessy reminded the committee that it was the ACA that offered the first protections for people with behavioral health illnesses.
Prior to this point, people with behavioral health illnesses could be discriminated against legally and be barred from having coverage in health plans.
No one at the public hearing testified against the proposal, but several insurance organizations testified neither for nor against. Catherine Pelletreau of the Maine Association of Health Plans says insurers are concerned that the bill only includes ACA protections for access and not affordability, because it fails to address components such as cost-sharing reductions and subsidies.
If the ACA is repealed, those issues are going to need to be addressed, as the coverage that's created by this bill raises costs to a point that would be largely unaffordable for many Maine people if those affordability aspects aren't there.
Kim Cook of Insurance Co-op Community Health Options suggested that the committee amend the bill to possibly include a requirement that all individuals have health insurance and create a funding mechanism so that all income levels can purchase coverage. The committee will consider whether to include affordability provisions in the bill during a work session on February 7th. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
This week, Maine lawmakers will consider the nomination of Jerry Reed to lead the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. A former Natural Resources Division chief at the Maine Attorney General's office, Reed has been praised as a talented and experienced environmental advocate. But for members of the Penobscot Nation, he is something else, the central figure in two legal cases that they say have undermined their cultural identity. As Susan Sharon reports, they and their allies are expected to turn out to oppose him.
As an assistant attorney general, Jerry Reed's job was to defend the state in cases like the Penobscot Nation versus Janet Mills, his former boss who served as attorney general and who is now Maine's governor. The case involved a dispute between the tribe and the state over who should have the authority to regulate paddlers, anglers, hunters, and trappers on the Penobscot River. In 2015, U.S. District Judge George Single ruled that the Penobscot Indian Reservation included Indian Island and dozens of islands northward, but not the waters of the river itself. And for Chief Kirk Francis and other members of the tribe, that was a devastating blow.
It's not only our namesake. I mean, we we treat that as a living, breathing, very spiritual thing. And the river is much more to us than just a body of water.
Losing the case was a painful and emotional process, Francis said, made more challenging by a decision from the First Circuit Court of Appeals 2 years later to uphold Singel's ruling. The court rejected a claim that the Penobscot Nation's sustenance fishing rights on the river were imperiled.
Well, we understand that that's a public resource a lot of people care about, and all we ever really asked in that case was that the unique and distinct culture that lives within it and the associated rights that to protect that are respected.
Because of contamination in the river, Francis says members of the tribe haven't been able to harvest a fish for sustenance or as a central part of their diet since about 1985. But there is one glimmer of hope for the Penobscot Nation in the dissenting opinion of First Circuit Judge Juan Torruella, who said fishing rights should be protected within the reservation, and that should include the islands and surrounding waters of the river. The tribe has now asked for a review of the First Circuit decision. Meanwhile, Francis says he has serious concerns about Reed's nomination, and other tribal members remain distrustful of Governor Janet Mills.
You know, her first day in office, she made known her choice for head of Department of Environmental Protection, and it was this man who is the face of the Penobscot Nation versus Attorney General Janet Mills court case.
Dawn Neptune Adams is a member of the Penobscot Nation and an environmental activist who plans to participate in a rally opposing Reed just ahead of his confirmation hearing Wednesday. Reed has also represented Maine in a separate federal court case involving water quality standards on the Penobscot River, which also puts the state and tribes at odds. Under the Obama administration, the Environmental Protection Agency had sided with the Penobscot Nation and other tribes' efforts to protect sustenance fisheries. Under the Trump administration, those standards are now up for review.
We're aligned with the tribes in helping protect the water quality of the Penobscot River and all other waterways in Maine.
Governor Mills says despite the legal cases that previously involved the state attorney general's office and the tribes, there are plenty of ways both sides have worked together on efforts to remove dams on the Penobscot and on fighting the federal government's efforts to roll back mercury and airborne toxins rules. And she stands by her nomination of Jerry Reed.
The fact is, Jerry Reed is a strong environmentalist, and he's done so much. Just take the Penobscot River. He's been there in the battleground against Mallinckrodt Incorporated, holding their feet to the fire to effectuate a $20-plus million remedy for the mercury they dumped at the mouth of the Penobscot River down by Orrington. He's been there to protect the river.
Mills says when it comes to improving water quality and fish consumption rates, the state and the tribes can be partners. Beth Ahern, political director for the group Maine Conservation Voters, says there's at least one positive signal on the horizon.
I just want to point out that Mr. Reed has pledged to immediately support legislation that's moving this year through the Maine legislature to improve the water quality in the Penobscot River. And that's an important first step. We all benefit from clean water.
As head of the DEP, Reed's job to set policy and enforce environmental regulations will be starkly different than it was in the Attorney General's office. And Ahern says her group supports Reed, who wants to take action to address climate change and to protect human health. But other environmental groups, including 350 Maine, plan to oppose Reed's nomination. Amy Eshoo is 350 Maine's program manager, who says the group has a long-standing relationship with the Penobscot Nation.
We just feel that he represented the state in an effort that really further eroded tribal sovereignty and their inherent rights to the river for the Penobscot. And we just felt that that was not a nomination we could support.
Eshoo says her group and others will be urging the Mills administration to select another candidate who doesn't have an adversarial relationship with Maine tribes. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
And a statewide film festival this week and next week marks the 125th anniversary of the birth of the celebrated director John Ford. He was born in Cape Elizabeth, grew up in Portland. Maine Calling's Jennifer Rook spoke with two scholars about his roots in Maine and his influence on cinema worldwide. Jonathan Cavallaro, Associate Professor of Rhetoric, Film, and Screen Studies at Bates College, and Michael Connolly, Professor of History and Political Science at St. Joseph's College, and the author of Ford in Focus. Connolly says Ford was born John Martin Feeney, whose parents were Irish immigrants who ran a store in Portland.
They were also Gaelic speakers, Irish speakers. They came from one of the three parts of Ireland that still today are speaking Irish. So that really made them a very distinguished family. And vis-a-vis the store, I think most of the things that were sold out of there were probably illegal. booze, you know, being prohibited in Maine at the time. But there were a few commodities to buy at the front of the store, I'm sure.
Well, turning to you, John Cavallaro, I want to have you put John Ford in perspective for us. How big of a deal as a director is he, especially for young people listening right now?
They don't get any bigger, I don't think. Ford is widely viewed as maybe one of the five most influential people in the history of movie making. He wasn't just influential on people like Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Hollywood directors. He's been influenced people like Akira Kurosawa in Japan, Abbas Kiarostami in Iran, Jean Renoir in France. These are filmmakers that when you look at the pantheon of directors in the history of global cinema, they're at the top, and they all list Ford as one of their influences. In fact, Orson Welles used to say, people ask him, who are your favorite filmmakers? And he said, I like the old masters, and by that I mean John Ford and John Ford and John Ford.
What was he known for? His sweeping landscapes, his westerns in Monument Valley, discovering John Wayne, or is that just a tiny tip of the iceberg?
All of that and more, I think. Visually, he's known for not cutting very much. And I think if you're not paying attention to Ford, you can think that his films are almost boring because he doesn't move the camera. He doesn't cut a lot. It doesn't look like a Marvel movie when you watch a John Ford film. But he was very careful about where he put the camera and very careful about how he used it. And in that way, he was able to capture exactly the perspective he wanted for each film. And when he would cut in for close-ups, they meant more because they weren't that frequent in his films.
And Michael, from your perspective, how did his background as the son of Irish immigrants influence his work?
I think that the fact that his parents were Gaelic speakers, as I mentioned before, coming from one of the poorest parts of Ireland, western part of County Galway, better known as Connemara, gave him a sensitivity of what it was like to be poor, to be on the margins, not to be from an elite family or in an elite area. And I think that in almost all of the films, I think Jonathan will agree with this, there were characters that were based on exactly that same kind of lifestyle, and he held them up. They were flawed heroes, like most of us. So I think he had a sensitivity that came from his family background that played out through almost all of his films.
Would it make us any happier if Luke Plummer was dead? One of his brothers would be after you with a gun. We'd never be safe. I don't want that kind of life, Ringo.
Well, I don't see what else I can do.
So I watched Stagecoach last night in preparation for the program today. I mean, which of the 140 films to pick? But and it struck me as I thought about the film that there's some irony in that there's an Irish boy from Portland, Maine, who defined, for better and worse, the whole idea of the mythic Western landscape for America.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And he was able to do it not just in that one film, which was incredibly important in the history, not just of his career, but of Westerns in general. But, you know, you look at his career and you see My Darling Clementine and you see The Searchers and you see The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and Fort Apache and Rio Grande. And She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. And the list just goes on and on and on. He used to say, I'm John Ford and I direct Westerns. He didn't say I'm a filmmaker. He didn't say I'm a director. He didn't say I make movies. He made Westerns.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, January 29th, 2019. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.